For the sermon this afternoon, I will give part two of a series of sermons on the fundamental beliefs of God's church. And you probably never guess what I'm going to talk about today. Fundamental belief number two is the angelic world and Satan. In the sermon today, I'll cover the subject of Satan. And during the Bible study, we will have an interactive discussion about the angelic world. I thought it might be good, and I've given sermons on Satan and the demons before, and I find that it's better to end on an up note, you know, than a downer. So I thought I'll begin with, this is actually, as I mentioned before, as you can see on the name on the cover of the PowerPoint is Mr. Frank's presentation, but he has loaned it to us from Foundation Institute. He said that I could use this to share it with the congregation. So anyway, what I'll be doing this afternoon is giving a sermon on the subject of Satan, the devil, and the demons. Then we'll have this short break, and then we'll convene again for the Bible study in about 10 minutes following services. And we'll talk about the angelic world in the Bible study. And I want to solicit some participation from all of you, so that'll be more of an interactive study when we get to that topic. So let's get started. Today in our culture, the subject of a belief in Satan is troubling. If you believe in Satan, you are likely to be burned up in hellfire because all of us have sinned and fallen short. We all know that. And if you don't believe in Satan, that means you don't believe in God and what he says, and you're going to hell. So, as the cartoon says, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. But today, the notion of a belief in Satan as a literal being is seen as a minority belief. Most people see Satan as kind of like a counterbalancing force. You know, the Darth Vader of the universe. Satan is seen as a mythical influence. There are many theories, of course, about hell and the devil. There are lots of jokes about the devil. I remember Flip Wilson and his comedic routine, many, I see a lot of you smiling, you may remember too. His favorite expression was, "The devil made me do it." And all of his jokes that he told, "The devil made me do it." But does the devil really exist? Do we believe that? If so, what does he do? What should we think about him? So let's take a look at this fundamental belief about the existence of a spirit world. And once again, I would encourage all of you to build a notebook of fundamental beliefs, because it is my intent to go through all 20 of our fundamental beliefs over the next 2 years, at least one a month. And for those of you who may have missed doctrine number one about the plurality of God, I have that handout on the table outside. There were a few extra copies. I know most of you got them, but there were a few extras. Today, I'm going to be giving a handout on this particular topic, but I would recommend you still take notes, because everything that's in the presentation will not be in the handout, but a lot of the material is. And start building a notebook. I've got a notebook at home about that thick, about 2 inches thick, on the fundamental beliefs of the church, and I keep adding to it. And I find it's very good just to go back and study occasionally and to read it occasionally. And it's good foundational material like we'll be covering today. Well, let's take a look at the fundamental belief. What does the fundamental belief of the church say? The angelic realm, consisting of various types of spirit beings, was created by God. A former covering cherub, Lucifer, rebelled against God's authority and became Satan the devil. As Lucifer, he influenced one-third of the angels to follow him. Those who followed him are now evil spirits known as demons. Satan the devil is the adversary of both God and mankind. He and his demons influence mankind to reject God and his law. These evil spirits have been allowed temporarily temporary dominion over the earth and have deceived the majority of human beings. The angels who remain faithful to God serve as ministering spirits to those responding to God's call. So that's our statement. It's very basic. This is called a fundamental belief. And much of what we'll cover as we go through all of these topics is basic material. It's foundational material. And I would like to begin in Revelation chapter 12. Let's go to Revelation 12. Revelation, the 12th chapter. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9 describes the devil in some pretty appropriate analogies. Revelation 12 and verse 9. And so the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. As I said, it's very descriptive here in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9 what the dragon is in these prophetic visions that John experienced. He's identified as the devil and Satan, one and the same. It's called the great dragon and the serpent. It's rather interesting to me that the dragon, whether you're talking about mythological lore, whether you're talking about fiction, or whether you're talking about fables, poetry, literature, or even film, who or what is pictured as probably the ultimate adversary of human beings? You know, the white knight goes out to slay the dragon, doesn't he? Because the dragon seemed to epitomize all that was evil and nasty and dangerous in culture. It's kind of interesting to me, and I'm sure any of you who visited Asia know this, that whenever you go to an Asian festival, like in Japan, Linda and I went to her cousin took us to a festival. Actually, a couple of festivals, and both occasions they have people underneath, you know, a paper mache head of a dragon and this silk body that follows, and it kind of twists and turns, you know, through the parade ground. It is the object of evil in many, many cultures, the great dragon. And in fact, the fierce dragon exemplified sometimes the empire when it was at war, you know, kind of undefeatable. This dragon. And Satan is pictured here as a dragon in the prophecies of Revelation. And I think for good reason. Also pictured as a serpent. I know that some people like serpents. You know, they get them as pets. But most human beings have an aversion to snakes. I certainly do. I know that my wife does. I know that many women do. I remember going to Ambassador College in the woods of Texas, and I was from Los Angeles, from Southern California, and I was looking forward to getting out of the big city and going to the country. And I was told that in East Texas, you have to be careful of the snakes, because in East Texas, the four poisonous snakes indigenous to America live there in abundance. You know, you get the copperhead, the water moccasin, the coral, and the rattlesnake, and they're all found in East Texas. In most of the parts of the country, you know, you have one or the other maybe, but not all of them. We don't have very many up here, except maybe some rattlers in the eastern part of the state, but I think. I've seen a few garden snakes around here, but generally I don't think there's a lot of poisonous asps around that you have to be careful of. But here I am, city kid in East Texas, and we decided to go for a picnic on the grounds there. We went down by the spring, and so we're down by the spring in one of the valleys there on the grounds of the Ambassador College campus outside of Big Sandy, Texas. And We were just lounging on the grass because there was some beautiful grass that was well fed by the springs in this little valley. If you've ever been to the Big Sandy campus, some of you may remember the spring. That's where all of us who camped during the feast went down and got our water. It was a very beautiful area, natural spring in the woods, and they cleared a lot of the trees away and made it park-like. And we were having a little picnic down there, and I was just leaning back in the grass talking with some fellow students, and somebody said, "Dave, look!" And I turned around, and about 6 inches from my hand was a copperhead snake. It was the first time I'd seen a poisonous snake that close. It was the last time I ever wanted to be that close to a poisonous snake. Quickly, I jerked my hand back. We jumped up, and we grabbed some sticks, and that poor snake, he'll never live again, let's put it that way. We made sure that he was not a danger to us or anyone else from that point forward. But during the 4 years that I spent at the college in Texas, I saw all four of those indigenous poisonous snakes in the U.S. at one time or another. Why is it that God would use the analogy of Satan as a snake? Well, because they sneak up on you when you least expect it. They're kind of stealthy, aren't they? They sneak up on their prey. And if you've ever watched one of the Disney films about snakes, you know, I still remember the one very clearly about the Sidewinder in the desert, the Sidewinder rattlesnake, and how they are so stealthy and they subtly can come up on their prey, usually the kangaroo rat in the desert at night. I mean, it's a remarkable thing that God has created. I mean, I admire it. I don't want one as a pet, but I admire them in some ways because they are so stealthy and quiet. And we see them as a natural enemy of man, don't we? Snakes. And the natural enemy of God's people and of mankind is Satan. So I think he's pictured pretty accurately and clearly here. Well, as we talk about Satan, let's go on and discuss a summary of what we believe Satan is. First of all, he's a spirit being created by God. Secondarily, he's an adversary of God and his people. Third, he has dominion over the world. And some people, of course, don't believe this. That's why they want to excuse it and say, well, you know, the world isn't all that bad, forgetting that God says the world is a mixture of good and evil. Not everything out there is rotten and bad, but Satan, oftentimes, as we will see, sprinkles an element of truth in with the lie. And it's a mixture of good and bad, good and evil. It's not all evil, not all bad in the world around us. But Satan has dominion, and he certainly has influenced the world around us in every way. He has deceived humanity, by and large. He's deceived humanity. And he is aided by a host of demons in this task that he has. Although being spirit, he can travel at the speed of light, the speed of thought, the speed of a word. And so can those demons, being spirit. So this is what we know about Satan, and we gain this again from what is said in the book of Revelation. There are hundreds of scriptures about Satan and the angelic world and the spirit world, and I don't have time to go through all of them today in this sermon to cover the fundamental belief, and I know it's going to be a couple of years getting through all of them anyway, and if we spent a great deal of time, we wouldn't be able to finish. So this is more of a survey of our fundamental belief regarding Satan. I would like to address the basic question, though. Does Satan exist? And let's go to Revelation 20. Revelation chapter 20, since we're in Revelation, let's go back a few pages to chapter 20. Revelation 20. I'd like to read verses 1 through 3. John again saying, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand." In verse 2 now, Revelation 20. "And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old who is the devil and Satan, again, identifying who the dragon is, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him to the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should not deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. And we're reminded of this every year at the Feast of Tabernacles, that Satan will be bound. Will be bound away from deceiving the world for 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ. Until 1,000 years were finished, but after these things he must be released again for a little while. Let's drop down to verse 10. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire. Again, he's the deceiver of the world. And brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. And again, it's scriptures that are misunderstood sometimes, like this one. We'll talk a little more in detail about this scripture as we get further into the message, but that caused people, I think of Satan in terms of just a bad guy or a bad influence, negative thought, rather than a literal being. But we believe and teach in the church that Satan is a literal being. 7 Old Testament books mention Satan by name. Genesis, 1 Chronicles, Job, Psalms, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Zechariah. What is interesting in the New Testament is every book in the New Testament mentions Satan or the devil. And Christ, of course, refers to the devil in Matthew 13. Let's turn there, Matthew chapter 13. Matthew 13 and verse 39. Here, Christ is talking about the parable of the sower. And he references in the parable an enemy that comes and plucks away some seeds that are sown. And he says in verse 39, identifying this individual, he says, "The enemy who sowed them is the devil." Talking about the tares that were sowed. "The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels." So Christ identifies the players in his own analogy, but clearly he says the enemy is the devil. Christ considered the devil an enemy. Christians should consider Satan the devil as an enemy, because he is, as we shall see exploring this further. I'd like to talk about the objectives that I have for us today in our message. There will be 7 of them that I'll cover, an 8th being the angelic realm, which we'll get to in the Bible study. But first of all is Satan, his origin and fall. Talk about that. And then we'll talk about Satan as a literal being. Is he really a literal being? And third, the character of Satan. What is his character like? Fourth, are the names of Satan. Because he does have specific names, and like God's names, they identify some of his own characteristics. Then we'll talk about some of his activities, some of his favorite activities that we should be alerted to and warned about and aware of. Then we're going to discuss the fate of Satan. What is his fate? And then lastly is that the saints are given victory over Satan by the power of God and his Spirit and of Christ. And then, as I mentioned, then we'll talk about the angelic realm, and we'll do that in our Bible study. Since this is such a huge subject, I want to give a little extra time to the angelic world in the Bible study. Okay, let's first of all talk about Satan, his origin and fall. I'd like to begin in Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14, as most of you know, are scriptures that describe Satan's attitude and the reasons that he fell and what was his eventual fate, which comes in the same chapters as we get there in our objectives. But let's begin in Ezekiel 28. And I'd like to break into the thought in verse 13. Ezekiel 28, verse 13. Of course, in verse 12, it says this is a lamentation against the king of Tyre. As we know, when we read the context, it's more than just the king of Tyre that's being addressed here. In verse 13, it says, you were in Eden. King of Tyre was not in Eden. Garden of Eden was closed off a long time before the king of Tyre came along. So in the context of this prophecy, which originally was poetry, we find Satan is identified and the king of Tyre just exemplified some of the characteristics that Satan had. Verse 13, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. And apparently, God had adorned him with the beauty that looks like precious stones. And those of you who've seen large precious stones know what I mean. They're beautiful. You can hardly take your eyes off them. Many years ago, I had the opportunity to go to the Tower of London and tour the tower, and the royal jewels are there. You know, they talk about the big diamonds of the world. And maybe you've seen some of these big jewels, big diamonds, precious stones. They're beautiful and they're mesmerizing. You look at them and under the right kind of light, you go, wow, you can hardly take your eyes off of them. Apparently, Satan was beautiful that way. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the turquoise, the emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes. He was created as a musical being too. And when God makes things, it ain't junk. You know, it's good stuff, as they say. It's beautiful. Was prepared for you on the day you were created. So he was a created being, but he was created spirit. He was created beautiful and talented. Let's go on to verse 14. You were the anointed cherub who covers. So at one time he was given the task to actually cover the throne of God. At the very throne of God. I established you. In other words, Satan at one time was appointed, as we shall learn in a minute, as Lucifer, to be right at the throne of God, to be given a certain amount of authority. You were on the holy mountain of God, in the very presence of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones, talking about the sea of glass and the location of the throne of God. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. At one point, sin was found in this created being. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence from within and you sinned. Now we get into a realm of speculation. What would cause this kind of trading and merchandising and violence? And the speculation is that when Satan and one-third of the angels were appointed this earth to prepare for man, that they enjoyed the precious things of the earth. The spirit learned to enjoy the physical. And they actually created some kind of a economic system. Perhaps where they traded precious metals and precious stones and things on the earth. They created a merchandising system, and it created lust, like riches often do. It created a desire to get. It created a desire to compete in order to get, to elevate oneself and put another down. As we'll read in a little bit, it was the whole focus of this sin was pride. You sinned, therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up, in verse 17, for your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. It says in verse 17, I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. And again, in this poetry, he's describing the fall of Satan and the fact that Satan was overcome by sin, by pride, by lust, and because of that, he wanted to conquer and be as great as or greater than God. He thought he was certainly capable of that. Let's next go to Isaiah 14, because these parallel accounts, Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14, really give us a good outline of the attitude behind Satan and why he fell. Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 15. Let's read Isaiah 14, verse 12. Verse 12 now of Isaiah 14. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. Lucifer literally means the morning star, which is a name of Christ. He was given a very lofty name. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you've said in your heart, I will ascend unto heaven, and I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, above all the angels, above God even. And I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north, and I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. And Sheol is a word, of course, for the pit or for the grave. He ascended from the very highest positions that God had appointed to him to the very lowest because sin was found in him. Pride. Notice these expressions that are related here. I will ascend unto heaven. That doesn't mean I will go there. It means I will take it over. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I want to rule over all the angels, not just a third of the angels. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation. He wanted to rule it all. He wanted the power. To be beautiful, to be talented wasn't enough. He wanted the power. And that's so often the case these days. As I've told you before, I've often wondered, why would somebody want to be a politician? You know, especially in the republic in which we live. Why would somebody want to be a president? Subject to extreme criticism. I mean, you name it. The only reason, because a lot of people who've run for this office, who have been a part of our government, are the rich and the famous, aren't they? They were talking the other day about members of Congress, and the majority of them now are millionaires. You know, they've already achieved a certain level of success. They've already got money. Many of them are handsome or pretty. Some of them are not so pretty and handsome, but and I don't mean to be negative about the politicians. Please understand. The point I'm trying to make is, why would you want that position? Well, it's easy to say. It's power. People want to have influence over other people. This is a very strong driver in human nature. And, of course, a lot of that comes from Satan. He had that drive. He wanted to replace God. He wanted to rule over God. He wanted to have all those things that God had. He was not content with what God had given him. And this, of course, led to his downfall. One other scripture we should probably read in addition to Isaiah 14 is Satan and his demons were cast to earth. Luke 10 verse 18, I won't turn there, but Christ said, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. You know, he was cast down to this earth, as other scriptures also tell us, but clearly Christ said, I beheld Satan. And he was cast to the earth with about a third of the angels, as we read in another place. Again, we don't have time to go through every scripture, but I want to cover the basics of the background. Now back to our objectives. Satan, his origin and fall, we talked about that. And now we're going to talk about Satan as a literal being, rather than just kind of a sense of evil, but as a literal being. Again, I'm not going to turn to these scriptures, but I do want to show them to you as highlights. First of all, Satan has intellect. Very smart. Very shrewd. The comparison that we talked about before, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness. He's crafty. We read in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3. Satan has will. We read in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 26. And that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. He still has an agenda. And even though he knows, or at least he's been told that he's going to lose the battle, Satan still fights on and tries to dominate God and his plan and his will. He's so deceived himself that he will win at the end. He still continues to force that will upon human beings. And thirdly, Satan has emotions. Revelation 12:17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman. So he is an emotional being. He has will. He has intellect. Not just a figment of somebody's imagination like you might find in a fictional story. Satan is a literal being. There are more attributes of Satan that we could talk about. Satan and the demons are literal beings and not influences. In Matthew 17, we read, and Jesus rebuked the demon and it came out of him. You know, that's just not an influence. That's a being. Satan and his demons can talk and shout, as we read in Luke chapter 4, verse 41. In Luke 4:41, and demons also came out of many, crying out and saying, you are the Christ, the Son of God. And also in Job 1, and the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? And Satan answered the Lord and said, you know, from going to and fro on the earth. So clearly the Bible reveals that Satan is literal. So we see that Satan and his demons walk to and fro. Matthew 12, verse 43. The unclean spirit was walking about, seeking an open mind, an unstable person that he could influence. Satan and his demons seek worship. They want to be worshiped. Again, this is far beyond this kind of thought that some people have that, well, it's just an influence. It's kind of just a bad thought realm out there. Satan is literal, and we believe and teach that in God's church. We see that in Luke chapter 4 and also Psalms 106. Satan and his demons seek worship. Let's take a look at a summary of Satan as a literal being. Number one, he has intellect. Number two, he has will. Number three, he has emotions. Number four, he's referred to as literal. Number five, he can talk and shout. Number six, he can walk to and fro. And seven, he seeks worship. All proving that Satan is literal, a literal being. His characteristics can only be applied to a literal being. Okay, let's go back to our objectives list. Talked about Satan as a literal being, also Satan, his origin and fall. Now we're going to talk about the character of Satan. What is Satan's character like? Again, I'm not going to turn to these scriptures, but I'll put up these points and we'll list some scriptures that you may want to make note of. First of all, he's presumptuous. He's aggressive and presumptuous. In Zechariah chapter 3, verses 1 through 2, it says, then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to oppose him. He's competitive. Somebody says right, he says left. Somebody says left, he says right. Somebody says daylight, he says dark. There have been a few times when, you know, I've engaged individuals, I've talked to people. And for some reason, there are, you know, sometimes people that want to be involved in a church, and you meet with them, and it seems like they have this, what I call, opposing spirit. They want to argue. They want to fight. You know, they want to take the adversarial position, if you will, all the time. They're presumptuous and adversarial. Of course, we know that Satan was proud. Ezekiel 28, 17, we read that verse. He's very prideful. And when oftentimes you meet individuals that are very prideful, you know they carry the similar spirit. Not that they're possessed by Satan, I'm not saying that, but remember, Satan influences the world. And these are characteristics of Satan. So naturally there would be people who would be influenced by these characteristics. Presumptuous, proud also. He's subtle and cunning and very deceptive. The ultimate shyster. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 3. But I fear lest somehow, Paul wrote, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. He's subtle and cunning and loves to deceive. He's also filled with self-ambition, promoting self. Revelation 13, 4. So they worshiped the dragon and gave authority to the beast. And he loves it when people worship him and he tries to get people's worship. As we see in Revelation chapter 13, verse 4. Well, let's again look at a summary of Satan's character. He's presumptuous, he's proud, he's subtle, cunning, full of deception, full of self-ambition. These are characteristics that Satan exhibited prior to his fall, and he exhibits since. Let's go back to our objectives list again. We hope you get your seatbelt on. We're moving right along in this topic. Again, the objectives we've covered so far is origin and fall, Satan as a literal being, the character of Satan, and now we're going to talk about the names of Satan. And I don't know, I found this very interesting when I was preparing this message and fine-tuning it. Again, there are a lot of names. I don't know if you can read all these in the back, but there are a number of names. Some of you can, some of you can't. The old people can't, the young people can. It's one of the pitfalls of old age is losing the eyesight, right? He's called the prince and power of the air. Why is he called the prince and the power of the air in Ephesians? Most of us, probably all of us, have experienced a thought that suddenly comes into your mind. Sometimes it's even a bizarre thought, but certainly a negative or sinful thought, a discouraging thought. I have. I'm sure all of you have too. Where does that come from? You're not even thinking along those lines. You're not even thinking about those topics. But suddenly this thought comes into your head and you kind of go, where did that come from? You ever gone through that kind of experience? Well, I think all of us have, haven't we? Where do those thoughts come from? They come from Satan. He's the prince of the power of the air, and he's sending those fiery darts, as they're talked about by Paul, those thoughts to us all the time. And of course, a test of our character is, what are we going to do with those thoughts? Do we entertain them? Or do we say, I shouldn't be thinking about that? Or where did that thought come from? And we move on to something that's more godly or more positive, which is, of course, building character and the task that we face every day. He's called the God of this age, or this cosmos, this world. The prince of this world, the prince of demons. We know he leads these one-third of the angels, the demons. He's called the accuser of the brethren. I don't know about you, but this always sobers me up. When I read, you know, the opening chapter of the chapters of the book of Job. And occasionally when I approach God in prayer, I go, you know, I know Satan has been there. He's probably accused me already. You know, but I want you to know, I need the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. I need to be forgiven of that thought or that act or that behavior. Please forgive me. But you can be assured, Satan, because his spirit sees, can't hide from Satan. And Satan accuses us. In Job, it says he accuses day and night. He's called Lucifer before his fall. It's called the wicked one, the dragon, the serpent, the adversary, Beelzebub, devil, murderer, liar, the Templar, the enemy, the roaring lion, the destroyer, the thief. These are names that are given to Satan. You know, Christ talked about him being the father of lies. And a thief. So there, as I've told the congregation before, and I will repeat it again, I think it's very important. Many of you are parents, you have children. If there are two commandments you want to make sure your children are disciplined and corrected for, it's breaking the commandment of lying and stealing. Work, those are the pillars of character for Christian children, and that's what we need to work on with our kids, to make sure that if they're lying, that they're corrected, if they're stealing, that they're corrected. Again, those are the pillars of righteous character, because they are some of the names of Satan, and that behavior comes directly from him. Okay, back to our objectives. We've talked about his origin, the fact he's a literal being, the character, the names of Satan, and now we're going to talk about the activities of Satan. Again, I'm going to go through these, and we'll list some scriptures to support them. We're going to go through them pretty fast. And by the way, if any of you would like a copy of this PowerPoint, I'd be happy to share it with you, as long as you don't share it with other people. In other words, I'll give it to you for your own edification. Some people don't even know what PowerPoint is, and that's okay. I won't share it with you. Satan is king and has dominion. It's one of his activities. He is king and he has dominion. As we read in Revelation chapter 9 and also in Acts 26. Satan's motive is to destroy. A couple of scriptures, John chapter 10 and 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. He is called the destroyer. That's his objective. He wants to destroy God's people. He wants to thwart God's plan. He wants to destroy our faith and confidence in God. He also wants to hinder the work of God. As I said, he wants to destroy God's plan, as we can read in Mark chapter 4 and verse 15, and also in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 18. And he affects man. He influences man. He has an effect on mankind. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 18, where Paul said that Satan hindered him from doing the will of God. Let's notice a little bit about some of the ways he acted and what he said. Let's go to the first lie. He's called the father of lies, the liar. Let's go to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis 3 and verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And again, some commentators say this may have actually been originally a dragon. Literally a dragon who was walking about. Maybe very beautiful. I don't know if you've seen some of the dragons. They call them dragons. They're not really dragons. They're big lizards. Years and years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Aruba, the island of Aruba, and I went to the resort that we were staying at, and I came around the corner, and I was shocked to see this beautiful blue-green lizard that was about 3 feet long. and stood about 6 inches off the ground. Yeah, you're beginning to think he was a dragon, right? But I stopped in my tracks and looked. I mean, it's just beautiful, this big lizard, iguanas, they have in these desert islands down in the south end of the Mediterranean, the Caribbean. And what was really alarming is later in the day, we were barbecuing on one of the grills at this resort. It was a timeshare resort, and they had kitchens and they had outdoor grills. We were grilling a steak, and these iguanas came up and were begging like dogs. And, you know, I cut off a little piece of fat and threw it down. They caught it like a dog, you know, would catch something you toss off the table. Womp! I went, whoa! I don't want to stick a finger down there, especially one that's about 4 or 5 feet in length. But they're pretty impressive. So whatever this was, it was very impressive to Eve. It came up, and of course it began talking to her and said, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Part truth, part lie. Very typical, right, of Satan. And then we read in the next few verses, down in verses 4 and 5, then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. The first lie, the promise of immortality. Knowledge will lead to immortality. Basically was his thesis. You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So this was the first lie. As all of us know, we're familiar with the story. Again, very interesting story. I'd love to go into more detail, but we need to move along. So this chart kind of illustrates the reality of Satan's influence. It is not this where the Christian is just influenced by the world and by the flesh and by Satan, but rather you'll notice the circle on the right. Satan's influence includes one-third of the spirit world, the world as a whole, human flesh, all human beings, and to some extent the Christian, where Paul described the struggle that goes on within us between the Spirit of God and the spirit of Satan. And the world. He's all pervasive. And this is the reality of Satan's influence. Okay, let's talk about Satan's weapons of warfare. Number one, that we see illustrated in this example in chapter 3 of Genesis, which could be a whole sermon. Weapon number one is doubt. Weapon number two is guilt. Weapon number three is discouragement. And weapon number four is just old-fashioned lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the pride of life. And really, you can kind of reduce it down to these four things, can't you, that influence us to depart from God and His way. Doubt, guilt, discouragement, and the lust of the flesh. Back to our objectives. We've talked about the origin and the fall of Satan. He's a literal being, his character, his names, his activities, and now we're going to talk about the fate of Satan, his fate. Let's go back to Ezekiel 28 and verse 16. Ezekiel 28 and verse 16. Very clearly, it is said here that I will cast you out as profane, out, as it says here. I will destroy you then I banned you from the mountain of God, drove you from among the fiery stones. So I drove you in disgrace and expelled you, and I cast you as profane from the mountain of God. There are some people who feel that God is going to destroy Satan. Certainly God is going to limit his behaviors, we read earlier, in his influence with human beings for 1,000 years, and release him for a while. But what is his ultimate fate? And a lot of it comes from a misunderstanding. I'd like to spend just a few minutes talking about this concept of the prophecy of what Satan's fate would be and what God would do. Well, first of all, he drove him out of heaven and gave him the earth as his primary area. But this word destroy that we find in the King James Version does not mean literally to wipe out. It has several different meanings, as you can see from the commentary here, and several different uses that you read in that list below. Exodus chapter 10, Numbers 21, Job 11, Psalms 142, and Ezekiel 19 that use this same Hebrew word, and it doesn't mean literally to take completely away or to destroy. It is a word that, of course, means to wander away or to lose oneself or to perish, undo or lose. And this is the prophecy regarding the fate of Satan that we just read. Christ made this statement in Luke 20 and verse 35 through 36 about spirit beings that he's created. Nor can they die, because they are equal to the angels. And again, one of the first rules of Bible study is the Bible does not contradict itself. So how then do we reconcile this word destroy that doesn't always mean completely obliterate and the prophecy concerning Satan? And again, I think if we go to the Azazel example, which symbolizes Satan in Leviticus 11, talks about the Azazel goat being presented alive and let him go for a scapegoat into the wilderness. So our view is that Satan will not be destroyed or cease to exist, but his fate, of course, is spelled out, as we will get to it in just a moment. Again, in Leviticus 16, verses 20 through 22, to an uninhabited land. And this was a picture, of course, the Azazel goat, of Satan's eventual fate. Past punishment, of course, is a type of the future for Satan. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the change of darkness to be reserved for judgment. And it's kind of interesting, the word here for hell is Tartaru, which means place of restraint, literally. It is the only place in the Bible where this Greek word is used and interpreted hell. It just means place of complete restraint. And of course, for some people who are very active, that would be hell, you know, to be restrained from what they like to do or what they would prefer to do. In fact, the study of the word would tells us Tartaru or Tartarus, which is in mythology of the ancients, was the part of Hades where the wicked were confined and tormented because they were not allowed to do what they normally did or what they wanted to do. The concept of the Greek word is one of restraint as a form of punishment. Okay, moving right along, Satan's fate, Matthew 25, verse 41, and also Revelation 20, verse 10. We read earlier, talking about the false prophet and the beast. A better translation, it's even this rendered this way in the RSV, is they were cast. They were cast. So very clearly, Christ and the prophecy in Revelation 20 says that Satan is going to be cast out. He's going to be restrained. He's going to be taken away from the influence. And we read in Jude 13, raging waves of the sea foaming up their own shame, wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. Again, talking about this restraint that Satan will experience. And very quickly, just do a comparison. Will Satan be destroyed? A number of scriptures, there are seven of them here, that indicate that no, he will not be destroyed, but completely restrained. in a state of darkness. And these that would say yes, these are sometimes scriptures that are used to try and prove that Satan will be destroyed or obliterated, basically constitute a misunderstanding of the words in these verses. Again, the Greek language tells us very clearly that it is a state of restraint. Timeline, which I found very interesting that Mr. Franks put together. The millennium begins. Christ and his saints reign on the earth for 1,000 years. Satan is bound for 1,000 years. He's unable to deceive mankind for that 1,000 years, so he's restrained for that period of time. The millennium ends. Then Satan is released to deceive after the millennium occurs to test that final generation who's enjoyed the reign of Christ for 1,000 years. Then after that rebellion, Satan and his angels are cast into the lake of fire with the false prophet and the beast. For them, it's a place of torment, not a place of destruction, as we've read earlier. Then the second and third resurrections occur. And then Satan and the demons are cast into outer darkness. Basically outlining the fate of Satan in a little bit of a chart that I hope helps. Okay, let's go on to our objective list. We've talked about the reward of Satan or the fate of Satan. And now, finally, the saints are given the victory over Satan. Just a few brief points to describe this. I think, again, we're all familiar with it. It's very basic. Christ gave disciples authority over Satan. Christ promised this in Matthew 10 and also in Romans 16. And the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. We have the ability, of course, with God's help and with God's Spirit and His power to overcome Satan. So we don't need to be afraid of him, even though he is very powerful and has a great deal of influence in the world. Secondarily, we must not be ignorant of his devices, some of which we've described today. As Paul warned in 2 Corinthians, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. We must actively resist Satan and not be entertained by him. I know a few years ago at one of our camps, one of the campers brought a Ouija board to camp, tarot cards, and they tried to get in touch with the spirit world in the camp one night. You know, you shouldn't play with fire like that because you may be inviting something in you can't handle or don't really know much about. We must actively resist Satan. And the admonition is very clear in James 4. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Ephesians 6, verse 11, Ephesians 4, 26 talk about the same thing. We must not give place to him. Which means we must have a sound mind, not an unsound mind. An unsound mind can't open itself to the influence of Satan. And we have to be careful of that. And we must destroy his works. And someday we will be involved directly in that. In Hebrews 2 and verse 14, let's turn there as a final scripture in the sermon. Hebrews Chapter 2 and verse 14. Hebrews 2:14. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, talking about Christ, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil. And we know eventually we win. We see the end of the movie. We know that God's people are victorious. And that the last enemy to be destroyed is death and the devil, who will be restrained forever. So we know his fate. We know that in the end, the saints rule and dominate Satan and win over him. And that we will have victory over Satan in the end. And again, this Greek word destroy means that he will become powerless. And so we have covered in the sermon today the origin and the fall of Satan. Satan as a literal being, the character of Satan, the names of Satan, the activities of Satan, the fate of Satan, and that saints will be given victory over Satan in the end. And let's take about a 10-minute break after we have another hymn and a prayer, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the angelic realm, the other side of the spirit world, which is much more pleasant and enjoyable to talk about. Zach?